You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey, y'all. Spooky season is here. And if you're looking for a show to whet your appetite for a little haunted history, then I'd like to invite you to check out Southern Gothic, a chart-topping history podcast that explores some of the most infamous legends, folklore, ghost stories, and hauntings of the American South. We've covered all sorts of stuff from the Bell Witch of Tennessee to the disappearance of the Confederate submarine, the H.L. Hunley, not to mention our deep dives into the local lore of some of America's oldest and most haunted cities, like New Orleans, Charleston, and St. Augustine. So, if you're ready for a little good old-fashioned Halloween storytelling with a commitment to quality historical research, then be sure to check out Southern Gothic today. It's available now on all your favorite podcast apps.
All right, quiet on the set.
Camera speed.
Sound production, take one.
Action!
Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era. Hear fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine, who quite literally lives just beneath the Hollywood Sign, and actress-writer Nan McNamara. Now your hosts, Steve and Nan.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. We're very excited that we're bringing you our, I think this is our second star of the month.
Third.
Oh, wait a minute. Sorry.
Yes.
This is our third star of the month for the month of May. And this guy, he's so strangely handsome, smooth talking, effortlessly charming, and it is none other than Zachary Scott.
And his name may not be familiar to you.
It won't, but you'll know him, I think, probably best from the great Michael Curtiz film, Mildred Pierce, from 1945. He plays the duplicitous charmer, Monty Barragán, who romances not only Mildred Pierce, played by Joan Crawford in her Oscar-winning performance, but also Mildred's daughter, Vida, played by Anne Blythe.
So kind of really a creep.
Yeah. And this became Zachary Scott's signature role. I mean, he excelled at portraying the sexy cad who's usually at his best when he's swindling or seducing or being a general scoundrel in every way.
Yes,
so it's what he was so good at, but it's not how he started out, which is really interesting.
Not at all. And unlike a lot of film villains, it was really fun to watch him be bad.
So fun.
I love that you wrote, he could rock a tux, look naked without a martini in his hand, and always had a cigarette close by. And I think you make a really good point that he was so magnetic on screen that you could really feel sorry for him.
You could. I mean, he was the bad guy, but you kind of were cheering for him a little bit.
Yes.
When he did get to play the good guy, he did it so well. And in fact, his film debut is a movie that I know you just watched.
Yes.
The Southerner from 1945, which was directed by the great Jean Renoir. And you realize that he started out as a real upstanding leading man a la Henry Fonda or Gregory Peck. But it seems like the minute they put the mustache on him, he got to play the bad boy and he kind of got typecast.
He did indeed. I think watching that film, The Southerner, he's almost unrecognizable from that stereotype.
Yes.
And he is really demonstrating the range that he has as an actor.
Yes.
The performance is exquisite. And by the way, Jean Renoir being the son of the Impressionist painter Renoir,
so
in case you didn't know that.
Good visual arts genes there.
Yeah, and the black and white film, it's beautifully shot. And his performance holds that whole film together. He is vulnerable. He is strong. He's handsome.
Yes.
And I love your comparing him to a Henry Fonda.
Watching The Southerner, it reminds you of a different version of The Greats of Wrath. You know,
right.
Except it's about sharecroppers in the South.
Yeah.
It had that same sort of heart and soul and angst. And he's just so beautiful in that movie that I wish he'd had more opportunities to play the straight leading man.
Agreed.
Rather than the caddish bad boy.
Right.
Although he did it so well.
Well, and his roots are from Austin, Texas. He was born February 21st, 1914. His father was a successful doctor who hoped that Zachary would follow in his footsteps.
Yes, and he did for a minute. You know, he did study pre-med at the University of Texas in Austin, but he decided it wasn't for him. And at 19, he dropped out. Broke his father's heart. He was kind of lost for a while. He worked as a seaman on an England-bound freighter. While he was in England, he joined a theater company, which sort of changed his life because he really found he had a knack for and a passion for acting.
Yeah, he did 24 plays in 2 years. He returns to Texas and he starts working in the Austin theater scene. He re-enrolls in school, this time as a drama major.
I'm sure his dad must have been so proud.
I remember how proud my parents were when I said, I'm going to major in theater.
Exactly. And you know, and it was in the theater program that he met his first wife. Her name was Elaine Anderson. They were married in 1934 and they had a daughter, Waverly Scott. They had her in 1936.
Right. Now, his fate was cemented when he and his wife were spotted in a play. This is an amazing story.
Yes.
By the great actor Alfred Lunt. If you don't know Alfred Lunt, Lunt and his wife Lynn Fontanne were really celebrated for their stage work.
Yes.
I mean, they were known in across the pond and in the United States as probably the greatest theater actors of an age. They also did appear in a couple of films, but mainly they're known for theater. He is impressed. Lunt is impressed with Zachary Scott and I think his wife.
Oh, he did. He was very impressed with Elaine Anderson as well.
Yeah, and so he recommends them to some producers in New York City, and he gets Scott his Broadway debut in 1941. Ah, Wilderness, one of my favorite Eugene O'Neill plays.
Yes.
And I cannot believe it did not do very well when it first landed on Broadway.
You know, it only ran for about a month,
yeah.
And then it closed. But he bounced back. The next year, he appeared in the comedy The Damask Cheek, which featured Flora Robeson, Myron McCormick, and Celeste Holm in one of her early performances.
Yeah. And his wife ends up finding work as a stage manager.
Yes, which actually, I think, became the bread and butter for the couple while
sure.
He was bouncing around from acting job to acting job.
I love that she was a stage manager. Those are tough cookies.
I know.
And they're good people.
They really are. He had another short run in a Broadway play called The Rock in 1943. And then he was cast in These Endearing Young Charms.
I love that. I don't know that play.
I don't know that play.
But it was, while it closed rather quickly, this is a pivotal moment because he is spotted by none other than Jack Warner from Warner Brothers Studio. As we've heard many actors in the past, it happens. They get seen by somebody.
Yeah.
And he sees a lot of potential in him, and he signs him to his first contract.
Yeah, talk about fortuitous.
Yeah.
You know. But by now, his wife, who's become a kind of a very seasoned stage manager, she gets a job as the assistant stage manager for the Broadway hit Oklahoma.
Wow.
Which, you can imagine, it allows them to set down roots in New York and make money and be a little more comfortable. So that's looking well. But Scott has to go to Los Angeles.
Yeah, because of Warner Brothers. So.
Because of the contract. So yeah. They're having to split their time between the two coasts, which is never easy.
Yeah. He makes a pretty amazing screen debut as the lead in The Mask of Demetrius, 1944, directed by Jean Negulosco.
Yes. And how many people get to start their film career? The leading role.
I think we've talked about one other person that whose name escapes me, but yes. And he's in it with Peter Lorre, Sidney Greenstreet, and another newcomer, Faye Emerson.
Yeah, which he actually went on to make several films with Faye Emerson.
Yeah, I noticed
that.
They
made a lot of movies together.
So the film begins with the leading man, played by Scott, already dead. The film receives mixed reviews, but he's a big hit.
Oh, yes.
He follows it up with a cameo in a film we've talked about before, Hollywood Canteen, star-studded film from 1944. And then he lands what we just talked about earlier in The Southerner, 1945. It's a tour de force performance of this determined farmer and his family struggling to make a life.
Yeah. And that movie, as wonderful as he is, the supporting cast is just as good. Betty Field, Beulah Bondi, J. Carroll Nash, they're all so fantastic at the top of their game. That 1-2 punch of those two movies should have put him in the stratosphere towards being a leading man.
Well, and he was in demand at Warner Brothers, So he is put in a great next film, which we all know, Mildred Pierce, 1945. As you mentioned, he plays Monty Barragán.
Yep.
And again, the film begins with him dead.
Him dead. It was just a theme with him. Yeah, he's always dead at the beginning of his movies.
The film is a huge hit, and he's once more overlooked for the Academy Award nomination.
Yes, which I think he was so good. I think he should have been nominated. But in my estimation, and as great of a hit as this was and how important it was for his career, I think this is the moment or the juncture in his career where things went a little astray.
Yes.
I think this was the first time he got typecast as that suave, debonair heel, and it stuck. I mean, he was so good that I think he got typecast right here, beginning with his very third movie.
Well, and I think at this time in the history of films, film noir was really taking off.
Yes.
One of the things I read about him said that of the first 19 films that he did, 11 of them were film noir.
Yeah.
So I think being contractually obligated to Warner Brothers, he did not have the choice
of the choice.
What he got to do. Yeah. And it's so unfortunate because he is an actor of such range.
Yes, and he could have just been that great leading man. But I think studios tended to put you in a corner. They pigeonhole you as to you're going to play this type of character and that's it. And they saw this in him, and so they start casting him in all these film noirs. I think he followed up Mildred Pierce with kind of a not well-known film noir, but it's called Danger Signal, also starring Faye Emerson.
We
talked about her. But it was just sort of a standard noir where he gets to romance these two sisters, played by Emerson and Mona Freeman. But of course, he wants their money. He's playing a villain.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think this is where the train starts to leave the station, where he becomes the go-to suave, sexy, debonair villain.
Yes, yes. And in a similar situation, Her Kind of Man, 1946, he plays a gangster competing with a Broadway critic for the love of singer Janice Paige.
Oh, who is Janice going to pick?
I know,
the gangster or the Broadway critic?
Broadway critic. And he's actually voted in 1946 by film exhibitors the third most promising star of tomorrow. But as you've noted, the typecasting has
already begun. Because at this point in his career, Warner Brothers, they should have given him stronger leading man roles. But if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yep.
So they just continued to place him in movies where he got to play this type of character he excelled in. Next up for him was a thankless role in an Ann Sheridan movie called The Unfaithful, and then sort of a lackluster supporting role in this Ronald Reagan, Alexis Smith Western called Stallion Road in 1947. But then he does get sort of an interesting part when he's lent to MGM to play the third lead in this very unlikely love triangle with Spencer Tracy and Lana Turner in Cass Timberlake.
Okay, I've never seen that film, but just seeing Spencer Tracy, Lana Turner, and Zachary Scott as a triangle, a romantic triangle, I'm having a hard time.
Well, yes. How old was Lana Turner and how old was Spencer Tracy?
I know. Well, after that, he's again back to playing a heel in Ruthless, 1948, with Sidney Greenstreet. So that was for Eagle Lion. So is he being loaned out to
He's being loaned out to
Beeb Studios.
Yeah, Poverty Row Studios.
Yeah.
So it tells you right there that the bloom is off the rose, I think, with Warner Brothers, and they're just lending him out to places and not really trying to construct a career path for him that's going to give him endurance and staying power.
Yeah. Now, he does have a success with Flamingo Road in 1949, again with Michael Curtiz and our good friend Joan Crawford playing opposite her again. And that is a relatively successful...
Yes, it's a nice soap opera.
I love that kind of movie.
And it did well at the box office, and I think critics liked it. So who doesn't love a little soapy Southern noir?
And who doesn't remember the spinoff television series in 1980 with Mark Harmon? Oh, my gosh.
And Morgan Fairchild, remember?
Of course.
She was the bitch, of course.
Yes.
And Christina Raines and John Beck and good old Stella Stevens and Howard Duff. It was delicious.
It was delicious. Delicious.
Didn't last long, but it was delicious.
But it was fun. All right. So that brings us to 1950, which is a pretty pivotal year for Zachary Scott. He is married for 15 years, and his wife has filed for divorce, citing mental cruelty. Now, we should say that it was not only widely rumored that she had fallen in love with John Steinbeck, but she ends up marrying John Steinbeck shortly after
like
the divorce.
2 minutes after they signed the divorce decree.
Right. So I'm not sure who is creating the mental cruelty there, but we'll leave that alone. So also around this same time, this is a really scary episode, Scott nearly drowns. He's rafting with his friend somewhere, I think, in Topanga Canyon.
They were
on a, you know, river rafting with his friend, actor John Emery. A riptide flips their boat.
Yeah.
Zachary Scott hits his head on a rock, is knocked unconscious. Emery manages to rescue him. He almost drowned. And from what I understand, that concussion, that hit on the head, also perhaps started a period of depression that he was going through.
Yes, definitely.
So after appearing in 5 films that year, this is another thing that happens, including the sympathetic role as a husband wrongly accused of murder in Shadow on the Wall.
Which is such a great movie.
Yeah, I really want to see that
one. I love this movie with Ann Southern and
our little girl, Gigi Perreau.
And he also gets a sympathetic role in a great Nicholas Ray film called Born to be Bad, which starred Joan Fontaine, as we all know, not my favorite. And it also starred Joan Leslie, my favorite.
Yes.
But he gets to play the good guy. You know, basically Joan Fontaine, it's sort of a little mini All About Eve. She plays this orphan girl who comes and infiltrates herself into this jet-set New York people's lives, and she wreaks havoc with her manipulation and her.
Okay.
And she ends up stealing Zachary Scott away from Joan Leslie, and all hell breaks loose. It's a really good movie, and he's really good in it.
Well, so then this next part of his career is just puzzling to me, because at this moment he is dropped by Warner Brothers, making him a freelance actor for the first time in his career. Now, that can be a good thing, as we know nowadays actors are independent. They can choose their next projects, they can produce things themselves. But back then, that must have felt like he was, you know, talk about drowning. It must have felt a little unsteady.
Adrift at sea without the security of the studio behind you.
Something happens in 1953. But before we do that and talk about that and the rest of his career, it's time for our Hollywood pop quiz.
And the pop quiz question today is, in 1963, Zachary Scott went back to Broadway, where he starred in a play called A Rainy Day in Newark. And it featured a young actor who would go on to be a cinema superstar. Who was the actor?
All right, we'll be back with the answer to that and more about our star of the month, Zachary Scott, after this.
Steve and Ed will be right back, but first, another stop on the Hollywood tour. Before Pearl Harbor in 1941, Hollywood's relationship to the Third Reich was a complex one. You see, film producers, particularly Jewish ones, had ample reason to dislike Nazis. But the U.S. was not yet at war with them, and it wasn't necessarily good for business to lampoon the government of a large foreign market. But with some exceptions, Hollywood tended to tread carefully in the late 1930s. Now, Charlie Chaplin famously lampooned Adolf Hitler in The Great Dictator. That was released in October of 1940. But the Three Stooges got the jump on Chaplin by 9 months. They released their own quickie Third Reich parody in January of that year, even though Chaplin's film had started production first. In January 1940, the Stooges released a two-reel short called You Nazi Spy, in which they played dim-witted wallpaper hangers. They're installed as dictators of the country of Moronica. Mo plays the Hitler-like leader, while Curly plays Field Marshal Gallstone. That's a mashup of Goering and Mussolini. And Larry is Propaganda Minister Pebble, a spoof of Goebbels. Various comic hijinks ensue, culminating in all three getting deposed and then eaten by lions. And in 1941, a sequel came out called I'll Never Heil Again. Now back to Steve and Ann from Beneath the Hollywood Sign.
Welcome back, everybody. We wanted to give a shout out to our listener of the week. Actually, it's a married couple.
Who, too?
Yes, and they both worked at one point in the film industry. Devin and Brad Curry, thank you so much for listening and for sharing the pod with so many people. We so appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
All right, so we left off.
He is not at Warner Brothers anymore.
He is not at Warner Brothers anymore.
The doors have closed.
And the quality of the films kind of goes downhill.
They do, you know, because he's a free agent now, so right. He sort of has to get his own roles.
And take what he can get.
I think the first film he did after leaving Warner Brothers was a real mediocre movie called Stronghold in 1951, which starred Veronica Lake. And that was sort of indicative of the types and the quality of films he was doing. But he did get, in 1951, to star in a really, really good movie. It's a movie I love. I've seen it several times. It's called The Secret of Convict Lake. He plays this bad, ruthless escaped convict who battles Glenn Ford and he terrorizes Gene Tierney in this real taut Western film noir.
Wow.
Really good performance. I mean, he plays the bad guy, but he just plays it like nobody's business.
And after that, he spends a lot of the 50s appearing on television.
Yes.
But he does have something wonderful happen in his personal life. In 1953, he gets married again, and he finds a Mississippi-born gal, actress Ruth Ford, who had been a member of Orson Welles' Mercury Theater and had appeared in Welles' early film Too Much Johnson with Joseph Cotten and John Houseman. So she's a wonderful actress, and I think we've talked about her on this podcast.
Yes, because people probably know her best. She plays Woodrow Wilson's daughter, Ellen, in the 1944 biopic Wilson, which starred Alexander Knox as the president and Geraldine Fitzgerald as the first lady.
They're married, and Ruth, who had been married previously, has a daughter, and Scott adopts her daughter to be his own, Shelley.
Yes. So now there's Waverly and Shelley in
right.
the family.
And they also had a child.
Oh, that's right.
Together.
Third child.
Right.
His, hers, and ours.
Yes, exactly. So as we mentioned, he's appearing on television in shows like Studio One, Chevron Theater, all those shows that are sponsored by a corporation, United States Steel Hour, Lux Video Theater.
Yes.
Pursuit, and a smattering of pretty forgettable films.
And I just said it to you off air, but, you know, to me, it's a shame that his career ended up the way it did because, you know, he worked a lot in the late 50s, from the mid-50s to the late 50s, but I think the quality of movies he was offered were bad, but he had to work. So he ended up being in all of these movies. These cheap westerns and these sandal and sword movies and just real cheap movies. Nothing really great, probably from 55 on. A couple that come to mind, Dead on Course, 1953 with Kay Kendall. And then Flame of the Islands, 1955 with Yvonne DiCarlo and Howard Duff.
Our Lily Munster.
Our Lily Munster when
yes.
she was va-va-voom gorgeous.
Va-va-voom. Well, in 1959, he returns to his stage roots and appears in the Broadway play Requiem for a Nun, which this is surprising to me. It was written by William Faulkner, and it did not do well.
No. You know what? Zachary Scott's luck on Broadway was not good.
It was not good, and he was such a...
Yes.
I mean, that was his beginnings. That
yeah.
was his roots. So it's a flop. It closes within a few months. He is in another show in a couple years later, a supporting role in A Rainy Day in Newark.
Which is our pop question of the day
right,
so or the week.
We won't talk about who's in that. But that one closes after 7 performances.
Yeah. His staying power on Broadway was short.
Yeah, which is unfortunate.
But, you know, the 60s roll around, and by now, Scott is just phoning it in. I think he's just taking whatever movies available to him without any discretion or any thought into it. Because I'm sure he's a working actor who needs to work and make money.
Right.
Which
he has a family.
I understand. Yeah.
yeah.
And it's sad because like the early promise seems to have eroded and he seems to have just transformed into this workhorse who didn't have much discretion in the roles he took because he's in all these unspectacular B-movies, which is really a shame. His final screen performance was in 1965 in a guest starring role on the television crime comedy series The Rogues, starring a dashing trio of David Niven, Charles Boyer, and Gig Young.
I think that's such an interesting genre. Crime comedy series.
I know.
I guess maybe like a Get Smart.
Maybe.
I don't know.
I know. I love that. I don't know that show, but
yeah.
that was his final performance.
Unfortunately, in 1965, he's diagnosed with brain cancer You know, I go back to that concussion, and I'm not a doctor, but
I know.
I wonder.
It makes you wonder the rafting accident.
Does.
Was that a factor in his brain cancer?
Yes. One of the things I read about that time in his life, he has the brain cancer, he's in New York, and his first wife, Elaine Steinbeck, they had grown apart, but they were now friends, Zachary Scott calls her to the New York hospital that he's staying at, and she enters the room and she sees his head has been shaved and she bursts into tears. And he's quoted as saying to his first wife, "I'm going home to die and I wanted to spend the day with you."
Aww.
Which she goes on to respond to this interviewer that he'd still be handsome to this day, she says. He died too soon.
Oh, so true.
Yeah.
After that, he did go home to die. He went home to his mother's home in Austin, Texas, and at age 51, he passed away October 3rd, 1965.
And the city of Austin has really claimed him as their famous son.
That's right. Local boy done good.
Yeah, which I love hearing.
Me too.
Yeah. There's a street named after him, Zach Scott.
Yep, and they renamed the Austin Civic Theater the Zachary Scott Theater after their native son.
Right.
Which is a fitting tribute to a man who loved the stage so much and gave the film world such a solid body of work.
So we're going to be listing these films at the end of the episode. But Steve, if you had two Zachary Scott films to recommend to somebody who's never seen one, I know what my two would be. What would your two be?
You know what? Our two might be the same.
Okay.
Because I would want you to see good Zachary Scott. So I would want you to see The Southerner.
Yep, that's on my list.
And I'd want you to see bad Zachary Scott. And you'd have to see Mildred Pierce.
Those are the two on my list as well.
Yes. Secret of Convict Lake is my third, for sure.
I'm going to have to look for that. Yeah. I have not seen that one. So,
yeah. Such a good actor. Such a good actor.
Love getting to highlight someone that you all out there might not know about.
So there is our May Star of the Month,
yes.
Zachary Scott.
I think it's time to give the answer to our Hollywood pop quiz.
And of course, the question was, in 1963, Zachary Scott goes back to Broadway. He appears in another Broadway play called A Rainy Day in Newark. And it featured a young actor who went on to become a cinematic superstar. Who was the actor?
Gene Hackman.
You got it. Did you know that?
I didn't see the show, but
it closed after 7.
Yeah.
Nobody saw the show.
Nobody saw the show.
But you're right, it was Gene Hackman.
That's pretty phenomenal.
So he must have been really young in 1963.
He must have been. Yeah. Well, thank you everybody for listening. We would love it if you would tell your friends about the podcast and follow us on social media. Our handle is @FromBeneathTheHollywoodSign. We are on YouTube where you can watch the podcast as well as Instagram and Facebook.
And also, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us. Let us know what your favorite Zachary Scott movie is.
Yeah.
You can reach us at info@FromBeneathTheHollywoodSign.com.
That's this week's View.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign.
You've been listening to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign with Steve Kubine and Nan McNamara, the podcast that celebrates amazing stories of Tinseltown from its golden era. Join us next week for another episode and learn something else about Hollywood you probably never knew. Take a moment and give us a 5-star rating and a positive review. And tell your friends about us, too. It'll help grow the podcast. Visit Steve's website at FromBeneathTheHollywoodSign.com. The executive producers are Steve Kubine and Nan McNamara. Executive producer and post-production supervisor, Lindsay Schnebley. This podcast is part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com to listen and subscribe to their other fine shows like The Box of Oddities and The Shallow End with Schnebley and Toth. Copyright 2024, all rights reserved. That's a wrap.